Then I started experimenting with different styles of jumping. I wasn't about to dive into a pool, but I started jumping off the building backward, doing Superman things. I would run out, and instead of jumping far ahead, I'd jump straight up and go into an arch and lie down and then go back straight into the pool. It didn't matter how deep the pools were. You didn't need much water to land in. If it's a shallow pool, as you hit the water, you let your body go sideways, so you're using the width of the water as well as the depth. My dad knew about the jumping, and he wasn't a fan. He didn't try to put a stop to it, but he'd lecture me from time to time. "Don't you go jumping. I know you're smoking pot all the time. It's not a good combination." At that point, we didn't communicate about a lot of things. He'd complain, and I'd ignore him and say, "Whatever. Fuck you." One day in June of that year, Mike and I had been eyeing this apartment building just down the block from my house. The pool was small and teardrop-shaped, and the deep end was the smallest section of the teardrop. To get to the top of the building, we had to climb over railings, and we made enough of a commotion climbing up that somebody started yelling at us to get down. We never even thought of aborting. I told Mike to go, and he jumped, and I heard the splash. Then I got up on the railing. I didn't even look down to see my angle. I was more concerned with the people who were yelling. I jumped, and as I was in the air, I realized that I'd put too much into the leap, and I was going to overshoot the pool, but there was nothing I could do about it. The concrete was coming up at me, and I landed smack on my heels and missed the pool by about 10 inches. I was dazed and fell back into the pool and started to sink. Somehow, despite being in paralytic shock, I managed to push myself out of the pool, roll over onto the lip of the concrete, and emit this inhuman sound that sounded like it came from the depths of Hades. I looked over and saw Mike, but I couldn't move. Somebody called an ambulance, and the paramedics clumsily rolled me onto a gurney, almost dropping me in the process. They didn't stabilize the stretcher in the back of the ambulance, so I was bumping around in agony the whole ride to the hospital. It was pain, shock, and horror, and I knew something was seriously wrong because I still couldn't move. They took me to Cedars-Sinai and did an x-ray, and after a while the doctor came into the room and said, "You broke your back, and it doesn't look so good." I had been keeping a pretty optimistic, stiff upper lip outlook on the whole thing, but when he gave me the prognosis, I started weeping. There goes my summer. There goes my athleticism. There goes my life. I started hitting on every nurse who came by, desperate for painkillers, but they wouldn't give me anything until the doctor had okayed it. Then Blackie came rushing in, screaming, "What did I tell you? Now who's right? Did I not tell you this would happen? You smoke pot, you jump off the thing, this was bound to happen." I just looked at the nurse and said, "Somebody take him away from here. He's not allowed in here." At last they got me medicated and rigged up a pulley system with a harness and a medical bustier girdle. I was told that my vertebrae were flattened like pancakes and that a month in traction would help stretch them back. During the first week in the hospital, I got visits from Mike and Hillel and a few other friends. By now I had won Haya over, and she was kind of my girlfriend. Once she came to visit and lay down on the bed with me and let me feel her up, which was a real treat. Okay, broke the back, but at least I've got my hands on the breasts of the girl I've been in love with since the first day of Spanish class. After 2 weeks of traction, I started getting stir-crazy. One day, Hillel came to visit, and I told him, "I can't stay here for a day longer. You have to get me out of here." He went downstairs to get the car ready, and I unstrapped the girdle, rolled over, and tilted myself up on my two feeble legs. With my bare ass flashing out of my hospital gown, I started lurching like Frankenstein down that hallway. All the nurses went crazy, screaming that I couldn't go anywhere for 2 more weeks, but I didn't care. Somehow, I made it down the steps, and Hillel helped me into the car. Before I went home, I made him drive me to the building where I had messed up so I could try to figure out what I'd done wrong. I spent the next few weeks horizontal in my own bed. I got some lovely visitations from a friend of my father's named Lark, who was a beautiful, relatively successful 20-something actress. She came by at all hours, during the day, late at night, whenever, just to fix me up sexually. I had gotten my girdle back, and I had to keep telling her to be real careful, but I was getting absolutely ridden by a wild nymphomaniac banshee. That made the convalescing time a little more pleasant. That summer I went back to Michigan, but I was still struggling with my back. Every time I'd get an x-ray, the doctors always said it didn't look good. It was crooked. The vertebrae were still smushed. It was never good news. But over time, my back progressively got better. At some point, Mike took a greyhound out to visit me. He showed up at my house after this torturous journey, looking totally haggard and sleep-deprived, since he had been squeezed the whole way between a giant, snoring Indian and someone who kept constantly throwing up. He had a penthouse with him, and I remember opening it up and all the pages were stuck together. That was the way it was when I got it, he lied. But he was as happy as a bunny rabbit once we got settled in. My mom treated him like her own son, and Steve let us take his car and explore Michigan. We took a camping trip to the Upper Peninsula. We visited my aunt and my cousins, and we went water skiing. We were two kids, grown up in some ways, but children in other ways. But certainly not thinking of ourselves as children. Thinking of ourselves as masters of the universe over all other life forms, including adults. We were hipper, cooler, smarter. We knew more about pretty much everything there was to know more about, and we were fine with that. Adolescence is such a fun time in your life, because you think you know it all, and you haven't gotten to the point where you realize you know almost nothing. So we had our summer fun. And when Mike was ready to go back, I remember my mom going to town with bags and bags of food for this poor kid who had to go on the Greyhound. She baked him a pecan pie and gave him a huge industrial-sized bag of Pepperidge Farm goldfish and treated him like a little prince. I went back for my second year at Fairfax, but things were getting increasingly troubled at home. After the bust, while my dad was waiting to be sentenced, he became a lot more careful. He stopped selling drugs completely and became the prototypical starving actor. We'd fight over the most mundane things. One time he was outraged that I ate a can of his soup. Another time I infuriated him when I ate a sandwich out of the refrigerator that he had been coveting all day. Around this time, Blackie also tried to impose a curfew on me. He arbitrarily decided that I had to be in by midnight. If I broke curfew, I'd be locked out. One night I went out skateboarding and got home a few minutes after midnight and the door was locked. I knocked and I knocked and knocked. There was no answer. Finally, he came to the door, totally incensed. What did I tell you? There's no getting in here after 12. He complained that he had to get up early to go to acting classes, and I was interrupting his sleep. This from the same guy who kept me up till 6 in the morning throughout my junior high years. The next time it happened, my neighbor came out and offered to let me crash on his couch, but I declined. I had tried to leave my window open a crack so I could sneak back in, but my dad was so security conscious that he'd make sure the house was airtight before he went to bed. So I had to wake Blackie again, and he was even madder this time. We had a shoving match in the kitchen, and he told me that I had to either follow his rules or get out. It was a no-brainer. I called Donde Bastone, this friend of mine, and asked if he wanted a roommate. I had met Donde during my first year at Fairfax, but by the 11th grade, he had dropped out and was dealing weed out of his own house on Wilcox. He was the only 16-year-old I knew who had it together enough to have his own pad and a great little car. He agreed to let me move in, but he laid out exactly how much rent I had to pay and what my responsibilities would be around the house. In the middle of the day, Haya came over in her huge car, and we started loading my stuff. It consisted of some clothes, my stereo, and a large neon shamrock billiard sign that my dad had given me. Unfortunately, as I was pulling out of the driveway, Blackie came home.
Whoa, where do you think you're going? He said.
I'm out. I'm leaving. You're seeing the end of me.
What's all this stuff in the car? He asked.
That's my stuff, I maintained.
It's not your stuff. It's my stuff.
You gave me this stuff, I reminded him.
I gave it to you as long as you're living under my roof. If you're not in the house, it's not your stuff.
We had this big argument over the belongings, which I lost, but I didn't even care at that point. I just wanted out. I moved in with Donde and immediately concluded that he was way ahead of his time in many different ways. For one, he had an extraordinary record collection, complete with special shelving units built to house it, and a really nice sound system. Part of his deal, along with being a knucklehead and smoking pot, was to play music all day and all night. Every waking hour in that house, there was a record spinning. Thankfully, he had incredible taste in music. He wasn't one of those guys who was exclusively into ska or punk rock or vintage blues. He was into everything. And because he had friends who worked at record companies, he was always getting advanced copies of albums by David Bowie or Talking Heads. Our house also became the party house, and we'd throw these rather gala affairs every couple of weekends. It was one of those periods when the drugs and alcohol were working to perfection and not interfering with getting work done, and no one was strung out on anything. Donde always seemed to come up with some cocaine for these parties, and cocaine then was a treat, not something that we had all the time, so we weren't carried away with it. Around this time, my relationship with Hillel intensified. I was taking a health class that was two doors down from Hillel's art class. His art teacher was very liberal, so I'd get passes from my health class to go to the bathroom, and I'd go and have some intense conversations while Hillel was doing his anatomical drawings. Mike and Hillel were also becoming friends and developing an interesting musical bond. Anthem was about to play a series of shows at other high schools, and out of nowhere, Hillel began to secretly teach Mike how to play the bass guitar. Todd, the current bass player in Anthem, wasn't a very good musician, though he did provide the band's PA system. But Hillel and Alan Michalski, the other guitarist, and Jack Irons, the drummer, were authentic musical talents, so Hillel was looking to replicate that on the bass. When Todd walked in on a rehearsal one day and saw little Mike playing Anthem songs on Todd's bass through Todd's bass amp, he took his equipment and quit the band. So Mike was in. Right before they started playing around, I approached Hillel and asked if I could introduce the band. Actually, I got the idea from Blackie, who had long been introducing his friends' bands with comic, ironic, Vegas-type speeches. Hillel agreed, and for my first introduction, I reworked one of Blackie's classic vamps. I used Cal Worthington, who had become famous in L.A. for his tacky late-night used auto ads. "Ladies and gentlemen, Cal Worthington calls them the hottest rockers in L.A. Their parents call them crazy, and the girls call them all the time. But I call them like I see them, and I call them Anthem," I screamed. Then I flew off the stage into the audience and danced for the entire show. It didn't matter one bit if I was the only person dancing. I was so into supporting my friend's art. But as much as I was a fan of the whole band, it really became about me and Mike and Hillel. Hillel had known Jack and Alan much longer, but when he found us, he felt that we were his guys. For one, Hillel was really into weed, and those other guys weren't. We were into insanity and pushing the envelope, and Alan and Jack were much more mama's boys. So me and Mike and Hillel became the real Three Musketeers for the next 2 years in high school. For our own amusement, we created alternate identities. Three Mexicans who spoke in stylized Cheech and Chong accents. I was Fuerte, strong. Mike was Paco, small. And Hillel was Flaco, slender. Together, we were Los Faces. We were a gang, but not a ruffian gang. We were a comedy gang. We spent hours and hours playing these characters, and it helped us develop a sense of camaraderie that would last for years. Meanwhile, my friendship with Haya was progressing, but not as smoothly as my bond with Mike and Hillel. We still had one major problem. I wasn't the nice Jewish boy her family had envisioned. I'll never forget the way she explained the situation to me. "This is how it is. I love you, you're my man, but my parents can never know because they don't want me to date someone who isn't Jewish. So as far as they're concerned, you and I are best friends and we work on school stuff together and that's it. Don't be affectionate toward me when you come over. Just act like my friend." It was hard. Her father barely spoke a word to me. Her mother was more cordial, but they both smelled something uncomfortable in their lives. And it was me. I could always see how their repression manifested itself in her psyche. As much as she tried not to limit herself to her parents' confined world, they still exerted a strong hold on her, a bond that she'd fight against, but when push came to shove, she'd never break it. She was their daughter. I knew she loved me, but she was afraid to go too far with that love. During 11th grade, I was crazy about the idea of making love to her. I'd had all of these different sexual experiences, but never one based in true love. I knew how much fun fucking could be, but here was a chance to do it for real. I was trying to get her to sleep with me, but she wouldn't commit. "No, give me time. I'm not ready. There's a birth control issue." She kept putting it off, and it became this ongoing, "Are you ready yet?" In the meantime, she'd give me hand jobs, which she was great at, but I wanted this girl in my arms while I was inside her. It was maddening. She was my world. I adored her. I would have done anything for her. But she wasn't giving it up. 7 months into the relationship, we went on a date, and I was wearing my best clothes, and I'd done my hair the best I could. We went back to my room with no intention of anything happening and started to kiss. We took off our clothes, and we were basically in a sphere of love and light and warmth, and the rest of the world disappeared. It was better than I ever could have dreamed. It was that thing I had been looking for, that love mixed with the rapture of sex. Once Haya and I started having a regular sexual relationship, I couldn't have been happier. I wanted to have sex with her all day and all night, every day and every night. If I didn't see her for a while, all I could think about was being with her. When I'd go on a trip to Michigan, I couldn't wait to see her again. Every song I listened to was about her. We had our special songs, David Bowie's Heroes and the Beatles' Here, There, and Everywhere. My senior year at Fairfax was rife with contradictions. Me and my friends were definitely outsiders, living by our own moral code, one tenet of which was, thou shalt steal your meals. Mike and I refined a method of food thievery that was unbeatable for about 2 years, until the supermarkets finally caught on to it. I would go into the market and fill up a little red plastic basket with the finest provisions they offered, filet mignon, lobsters, cognac, you name it. Then I'd take my basket over to the magazine rack, which was directly adjacent to the entrance. I'd pick up a magazine and set my basket on the floor, and while I was perusing the magazine, I'd surreptitiously slide the basket under the chrome railing. Then Mike, who had been waiting outside, would dash in, grab the basket, and go right out the exit door. Soon we had an 8-foot-tall stack of empty red baskets behind my house, a testament to our continuing ability to feed ourselves in style. We still used our old tried-and-true bottle-up-the-pants method to steal booze. Once I even upped the ante and stole a pair of skis. I went to the back of the sporting goods store and asked, "What's the best pair of skis you have in here in my size?" The salesman said, "Well, these racing skis." I waited for him to leave, and I picked up the skis and walked right out the front door. I had decided that if I walked boldly right past the cashier, they would think he's picking up something that he's already paid for because he's not stopping. In some respects, our antisocial impulses were getting reinforced by the music that we were listening to. When I first started Fairfax in 1977, punk rock had just begun to make itself felt in Los Angeles, but it was a tiny subculture. Blackie, to his credit, was on the cutting edge of the new music scene. He was one of the first people to frequent a punk rock club called The Mask, which was on Hollywood Boulevard. Whenever punk rock groups from New York would come to town, they'd play the whiskey, and Blackie and I would always wind up at the Tropicana Motel, a seedy old classic paradise on Santa Monica Boulevard, which was where the band stayed and where the after parties were. At that time, my favorite record was Blondie's First. Every one of those songs was indelibly etched on my soul, and I was totally in love with Deborah Harry. So when Blondie came to town, we headed to the Tropicana for the party. They had a suite, and Debbie was in the front room. We started talking, and I was smitten, totally melting. In my delusional state, I thought, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You might never see this woman again. You better make your move. With complete earnestness, I said, I know I haven't known you that long, but will you marry me? She smiled and said, that's so kind of you to ask. I think you're a great guy, but I don't know if you know this, that guitar player I was playing with tonight, who's back there in the bedroom. Well, that's my husband. We're very happily married, and I really don't have any room in my life for another man. I was crushed. Mike and I began hanging out in the punk scene by necessity. Shortly after we started Fairfax, I had brought Mike to the Rainbow one night. Before we got there, we drank a lot of Michelob beer. I had a tolerance for alcohol, but apparently he didn't. We were sitting at Blackie's power table, and the girls were there, and the music was going, and Mike looked at me and said, I'm not feeling so good. He started to rush outside, but before he could go 2 feet, he began projectile vomiting all over the Rainbow. Not what they wanted from 2 underage kids in their establishment. He threw up all the way into the parking lot, where they gave him the boot. Then they came in for me and said, get out there with him. You're never coming back here again. I kept trying to get back in for a year, but they had really 86'd me. It was time to find my own scene. My first punk concert was a daytime show at the Palladium. Devo was playing, along with the Germs. I was standing in the back, just fascinated. The music was cool as shit. These people looked incredible, almost too cool for me. There was no way I could ever be accepted by this crowd, because they were light years ahead of me in terms of style. I remember walking over to the side of the stage, where people were going in and out of the backstage area, and there was this girl with some fucked up punk rock haircut, and she was taking giant safety pins and piercing her cheek with them. one after the other. That was new to me. Mike and I began trying to worm our way into this new scene, where, unlike at the Rainbow, I had no clout. There was an explosion of amazing bands in L.A. at the time. X and the Circle Jerks and Black Flag and China White. The list could go on and on. The energy was unbridled, more creative and exciting and bombastic than anything anybody had ever seen. Fashion-wise, energy-wise, dance-wise, music-wise, it was like the dawning of the Renaissance in my own town. Rock had become this boring old beast, ready to die, and now there was fresh, crazy-ass blood flowing through the streets of Hollywood. The first wave of punk rock had already crested, but there was a second coming. It wasn't a violent hardcore scene like the bands from Orange County. In Hollywood, it was more about creativity and originality. The Screamers and the Weirdos were two of Hollywood's first punk rock bands, but they sounded nothing alike. What all these bands did share was an element of anarchy and nonconformity. That first X record, or all of the Black Flag records from that time, were masterpieces. Darby Crash's lyrics for the Germs were as good as it ever got in the world of punk rock. He was on to a whole other level of intelligence. So Mike and I hung out in the parking lot of the Starwood, probably the best punk rock venue around then, and we started to poke our noses through the door of this world. The Starwood was a tough club to sneak into, but there was a side door near the parking lot guarded by a huge bouncer. If a fight broke out and his attention got diverted, we'd slip in as fast as we could. Sometimes, if a bunch of people were going in, we tried the crawling thing and used them as cover. When we couldn't sneak into the show, we'd linger in the parking lot. But neither of us had a lot of mojo or game, so we'd have to watch the goings-on. Nobody was inviting us to hang out. One time, Mike and I sneaked into the Starwood for a Black Flag show. We were fish out of water. We loved these bands, but we dressed all wrong, and we had the wrong haircuts and the wrong shoes, and we didn't even dance like all the punks. Those guys had the really cool boots with the chains wrapped around them and the right combination of ripped-up plaid clothes and spiked haircuts. Mike and I were lucky to have one leather jacket between the two of us. Black Flag put on an amazing show. They had a guy on stage called Mugger, who was in charge of security. Every time someone tried to jump up on stage and dance around a bit and then jump back off, Mugger would just attack the person and get into a brutal fist fight. During all this, the band did not miss a beat. One guy managed to get past Mugger and stage dive. He flew right by me, and I got kicked in the head with his heavy steel-toed boot. I almost passed out. One of the reasons we didn't plunge feet first into this scene was that in some ways, we were still model students at Fairfax. At least I was. It was a strange dichotomy. I smoked tons of pot, took pills, and drank on the weekends. But it never got out of control. I never missed school. It was important to me to be the straight-A student. In a way, I was a rebel by getting good grades, because most of the stoners and the druggies were getting no grades. I didn't want to be like them. When I was a junior, I got my report card and it was A's all the way down the line, which I loved. I wanted to be the best at whatever it was that was in front of me, on my terms. I didn't necessarily want to study for hours to get there, but I wanted to do enough at the last minute. By this time, we were all thinking about college. At the end of my senior year, my grades were starting to slip, and I had to go to Mrs. Lopez, my Spanish teacher, and beg, borrow, and steal to get a B. Mike was having his own problems with grades. He always vacillated between being an absolutely brilliant student and an absolute flunkout. Our last semester, he was in Don Platt's honors history class with Haya. Platt was a no-nonsense general who was in total command of his class. He was bald but in great physical shape, with a perfect tan, a suave Gavin McLeod type. Mike and I had been running around like maniacs the week before his big final, and he didn't study for it, so he cheated. The last guy on planet Earth you'd want to get busted by for cheating was Don Platt. He was not afraid to call you out in front of the class and humiliate you. That's what he did to Mike, who came out of class that day white as a ghost. Getting a D in Platt's class would put a pretty major dent in Mike's chances for getting a good grade point average. But it wasn't my worry. I was already a shoo-in to college with my grades. In fact, I planned to go to Don Platt for one of my recommendations so I could go to UCLA. I had been Platt's student for 3 years, and I had aced every one of his classes, so I knew he'd give me the crown jewel of all recommendations. A few days later, I went to see him after school, and he had a very unwelcoming look on his face. I asked him for a recommendation, and it was as if he already had a speech prepared. "Anyone who associates with Michael Balzeri is not a friend of mine, nor is he getting a recommendation from me. For all I know, you and Michael were cheating the whole time you were in my classes." This was absurd. I was probably the best student he'd had in 10 years. The only time I'd even come close to crossing him was in my first semester. I had chosen to do an oral report on Uriah P. Levy, who was a great American naval officer. During the course of my research, I discovered the derivation of the word fuck. It came from the early naval logs that the captain would keep. If a crew member was punished for having sexual intercourse, it was noted in the log as fuck, for unlawful carnal knowledge. That was too good a factoid not to share with the class. So I was up there spieling on Uriah P. Levy and the Navy, and it was all Monty Python-esque to me. I got to the punishable offenses, and I walked up to the chalkboard and wrote F-U-C-K in huge letters. I looked over at Mr. Platt, and the blood was rushing to the top of his bald head, but I never cracked a smile and continued to explain the concept. Meanwhile, Mike and the rest of the class came unglued, but there was nothing Platt could do. I had him. Now he thought he had me. I tried to make my case for the recommendation, but he wasn't having any of it. "There's the door," he said. I walked out of there shell-shocked. Ultimately, I wound up going to the geometry teacher, and he was nice enough to write me a great recommendation. But I still had to get even with Platt. Somewhere along the line that semester, I had stumbled upon some cardboard boxes of beautiful, big black and red plastic marquee letters. Thinking they might be useful for an art project, I kept them. At the end of that Memorial Day weekend, the night before we were supposed to return to classes, Mike and I were driving around, stoned on pot, listening to music, when a brilliant idea came to me. We drove up to the marquee in front of Fairfax High and started climbing up the pole, armed with the appropriate letters. Then we spelled out, "Dandy Don Platt sucks anus," and motor oiled the pole and the platform to inhibit the progress of anyone who would try to take our message down. We looked up at the sign, congratulated each other, and went home and fell asleep. The next day we went to school, and there was a whole hubbub of activity around the marquee. People taking pictures, and workmen trying to circumvent the motor oil and get those letters off. Nobody ever came to Mike or me for questioning. We weren't even suspects. Maybe Platt had screwed over enough kids that there was an abundance of people with a motive. But that wasn't the end of it. At the end of that summer, we decided to leave a message for the incoming class at Fairfax. So we went back to the box of letters, climbed back up that pole, and left, "Dandy Don continues to suck anus." Chapter 4. Under the 01 Sun. I was thrilled to find out I'd been accepted to UCLA. Not only was I going to the same university my father had, but Haya, who could have gotten into any school in the country, had chosen to stay home and go to college with me. It was like the planets had aligned. But I came back down to Earth pretty fast. I never felt at home at UCLA. The student body was filled with Poindexters and Asian kids who weren't there to socialize or yuck it up at all. Everyone there was all business all the time. I didn't make one friend the entire time I was there. Besides, club going and partying at Donde's house and running around with Hillel and Mike was way more important to me than studying Chinese history, which was, don't ask me why, one of the classes I signed up for. On top of these general woes, my finances were completely on the skids. I had no income except for the $20 a month my mom was sending me. So I reverted to my old practices. When it came to getting textbooks, which were incredibly expensive, I went to the campus bookstore, filled up my basket, walked over by the exit, nudged it past the censors, then bought a pack of gum and picked up my free books on the way out. When it came to food, I'd go to the school cafeteria, which had a great selection of hot and cold meals, and fill up a tray. Before I got to the register, I'd start going backward in line, as if picking up things I had missed, until I got to the end of the line. Then I'd walk out with the food. I never got caught. Hillel would often come and join me, because he was on a budget too. Those meals with him were probably the most joyous moments of my college career. That year, Hillel, Mike, and I perfected something we called dining and dashing. We'd pick restaurants that had a lot of traffic and a lot of waitresses, like Cantor's on Fairfax. We'd eat our food, then individually slip out the door. The sad thing was, we didn't stop to think that these poor waitresses were getting stuck with a check. And even if the restaurant didn't make them pay for our meal, they weren't getting their tips. It wasn't until years later, when I had to examine the consequences of some of my earlier behavior, that I began to make amends by going back to these places and putting some money in their tills. Hillel had a lot of free time on his hands that first semester, because he didn't go on to college after Fairfax. I'd meet him after school and hang out with him on the weekends and get high on pot. He was a late bloomer to drug use, but he loved his weed. I relished the time I spent with him, since I sure wasn't looking forward to school. I hated all my classes except one, an expository composition class taught by a young female professor. Each week we had to write a composition that she'd critique. Even though I was the great procrastinator and would wait until the night before the paper was due to even think about it, I loved that class. I got an A on every paper, and like Jill Vernon, the teacher would keep me after class and encourage me to write more. If some of my other classes had been Recreational Drug Taking 101, or, better yet, Advanced Coke Shooting, I might have fared better at UCLA. I was 14 the first time I shot coke. I was at one of my dad's parties back on Palm Street, watching all the adults shooting up, and I badgered them into making up a small load and shooting me up. At the end of my senior year at Fairfax, I started shooting up again. One of the first times I was alone at home and felt so ecstatic that I called Haya. I told her, "This is the greatest feeling ever. We have to do this together." I didn't see it as a road to death and insanity. I just saw it as a beautiful, beautiful feeling. As euphoric as that feeling is, the come down from shooting coke is horrific. Dante's Inferno times 10. You fall into a dark and demonic, depressing place, in an agonizing state of discomfort because all of these chemicals that you normally have to release ever so slowly to keep yourself comfortable in your skin are now gone, and you have nothing inside to make you feel okay. That's one of the reasons I took heroin a few years later, became the 80-foot pillow to break that cocaine fall. I never had any qualms about using needles to ingest drugs. Once I even made shooting up into a weird art project. I was still at Fairfax, and I'd had a fight with Haya. She had been ignoring me for a couple of days, so I drove over to her dad's store, where she worked. I pulled up in front of her car and, in broad daylight, stuck an empty syringe into my arm and drew out a couple cc's of fresh blood. Then I walked up to her car, squirted the blood back into the palm of my hand, smeared it on my mouth, and made blood kisses all over her windshield and the driver's side window. My romantic little blood project worked. I went home, and I got a call later that day. "I got your message. That was so nice. I love you so much." Unfortunately, the blood stained the glass, and despite repeated washings, we never could erase all the traces of those blood kisses. I was comfortable with syringes, but my dilemma was how to get them. I figured it out one day when I was walking through a supermarket that had a pharmacy. I saw an advertisement for insulin, and a light bulb went off in my head. I realized that if I went up to the counter and acted like a diabetic and ordered my insulin first, when I asked for syringes, they wouldn't even question it. I marched up and ordered the Lente U100 insulin. The pharmacist went to the refrigerator and got out a box of insulin vials, and as he was walking back, I offhandly said, you'd better throw in a pack of Microfine 3s, too. Without missing a beat, he grabbed some syringes. That scam worked for me for years and years. My drug use increased exponentially during that first year at UCLA. I knew that just down the road, life was in session, and that was where I would go for my education, which included going to every concert I could afford. I saw the Talking Heads and the Police. I even went to New York with Donde to visit his family and see some shows. It was Donde's birthday, so we dropped some acid and went to Trax to see John Lurie and the Lounge Lizards, then to the Bottom Line to take in Arthur Blythe. To our amazement, Blythe had Kelvin Bell, the great guitar player from Defunct, playing with him. The show was incredible, and after it was over, I went to the bar and talked to Kelvin about music and about his guitar playing and the records that I knew he played on. He was very happy to engage about music with this 18-year-old boy from Hollywood who was blazing on acid. I was excited because Kelvin was one of the people who had gotten me seriously into music. Donde had his Defunct album, and when we'd have people over to the house, he'd put it on and say, "Everyone get around. Anthony's going to dance." And I'd bust some moves. Dancing became this playful competition for us, and at one point we all started going to dance contests. We'd show up at Osco's, a hip-punk rock disco on La Cienega, and Hillel and Mike and I would enter the contest. We were off the map. Most people would break out conventional dance moves that you'd seen before, but we'd go out and invent steps. Besides constantly playing records, Donde also had an inexpensive electric guitar and an amplifier. On the weekends, when he wasn't working at his dad's telephone answering service, he would sit there and bang away on this electric guitar. He knew a few chords, but he had a really harsh tone, so when he'd start noodling around, I usually got out of the house. Still, one day Donde suggested that he and I and Mike should form a band. He'd play guitar, I'd sing, and Mike would play bass. Though it was more of a joke than anything else, we rehearsed a few times at his dad's theater in Hollywood. The biggest contribution to this project was the name. Our friend Patrick English used to refer to his dick as a spigot, and I thought it was such a fantastic nickname that I became Spigot Blister. Donde named himself Skidmark. I forget Mike's name. We called ourselves Spigot Blister and the Chest Pimps, the chest pimps being the pimples that resided on Mike's pubescent chest. Our rehearsals consisted mostly of making noise. In retrospect, it was more of an exercise in coming up with personas than coming up with music. We didn't write any songs or even any lyrics. We just made some bad noise and screamed and banged on things. Eventually, we lost interest in the whole project. But seeing Kelvin Bell was inspirational for me, and I had a distinct feeling, even though I didn't have a concrete means of achieving it, that whatever I ended up doing with my life, I wanted to make people feel the way this music was making me feel. The only problem was that I wasn't a guitar player, and I wasn't a bass player, and I wasn't a drummer, and I wasn't a singer. I was a dancer and a party maniac, and I didn't quite know how to parlay that into a job. Every attempt that I'd made to even keep a job had turned into a dismal failure. Back at Fairfax, I went through a succession of shitty little jobs that highlighted how incapable I was of fitting into society. I worked at a collections agency, I worked for a country store, I even worked as an underage waiter at the Improv, but I got canned from each of these gigs. At UCLA, I was so desperate for money that I read a notice on the crappy jobs where you can exploit the students and get them to work for nothing board that a rich family in Hancock Park needed a dog walker for their two German shepherds. I didn't mind taking the daily walk, and I didn't mind hanging out with the dogs, but it was a pathetic situation to have to walk these dogs for all of $25 a week. Sometime during that first year, I couldn't pay Donde rent anymore, so I had to leave. I went back to that same job board and found a notice that said, "Room and board for young male student willing to participate in the caretaking of a 9-year-old boy. Single mother needs help taking the boy to and from school." The woman lived in a small quaint house in Beverlywood. She was a young mom who'd been jilted by some dude and was now alone with a so-called hyperactive attention deficit kid who was being dosed with Ritalin. She liked me right away. My responsibilities weren't that great, basically making sure that the kid got to school in the morning and was picked up in the afternoon and served a snack. For me, it was ideal. I had a roof over my head, some food in my stomach, and a nice room where Haya would regularly visit and we would engage in some noisy lovemaking sessions. After a while, I bonded with the little guy. He might have been a touch mentally challenged, but he wasn't hyperactive or suffering from a shortened attention span. When we were together, he wasn't spastic or out of control. I had read that when adults took Ritalin, instead of having a calming effect, it would stimulate the post-adolescent chemical balance. One night, Hillel and Mike came over, and we decided to test those theories. Sure enough, in combination with a nice stolen bottle of Finnish vodka, we were off to the races. We ate handfuls of the Ritalin and became three drunk comets running around the house. The kid had a great time, and when his mom and her date came home a bit tipsy, she partied with us, never realizing that we were high on her son's meds. Eventually, though, she fired me from the job. I was almost history at school, too. From the first few weeks, I had felt totally alienated from campus life, so much of an outsider that I memorialized the feeling with a harsh, bizarre haircut. I decided to cut all of my hair really short except for the back, which was long, down to my shoulders. I wasn't mimicking hockey players or people from Canada. It was just my idea of a punk rock haircut. It was probably inspired by David Bowie and his pinups era, but it wasn't flaming red, and I didn't have the standing up thing in the front. I had bangs. To people at UCLA, it was abominable. Even my friends were freaked out by it. But Mike approved. He always said that one of my greatest accomplishments was that I had invented the mullet. The height of my alienation from UCLA came later that year. Mike and Hillel and I had just finished one of our Cantor's dine-in dashes. We were tripping on acid, wandering the streets. We passed an alleyway, and I stumbled on all these clothes that had been discarded by a bum. I immediately had an acidic moment of clarity and stripped naked and donned this oversized, strange, mismatched set of clothes. In a way, they were beautiful and regal. The pants even had some kind of silk iridescent pattern streaking down. Combined with the spigot blister haircut, I was quite a sight. I stayed up all night, and in the morning I went to my classes wearing this mystical bum outfit. But I was still hungover from the acid, so I went out and lay down on the lawn. Haya spotted me. "What's wrong with you?" she asked. "I've been up all night on acid, and I can't hack my astronomy class right now," I said. "You look terrible," she said. She was right. I looked terrible, and I felt terrible. And that was the moment when I realized that I wasn't going to cut it in this environment. What I didn't realize then was that Haya and I were not going to make it either. I'd had two regrettable instances of infidelity during that year at UCLA. The first was with a well-endowed party girl. She kept coming by my house and wouldn't leave me alone. Before we went out dancing one night, I made it clear to her that I was in a committed relationship. But I have a sneaking suspicion that we split a quaalude at some point that night and went back to her apartment. She started to make sexual advances, and I remember thinking, I'm going to do this. I'm going to sleep with this girl, and I'm going to regret it forever, but I can't stop myself. She disrobed, I lost all control, and I slept with her. I had a great time and then felt just crushed, demoralized, and disgusted with myself afterward. You instinctively know that nothing will ever be the same, and you have to carry that knowledge around with you like a huge weight. The next time you see your girl, you can't look at her straight in the eyes the same way you did for all those years. The second infidelity was even worse. I was writing a paper for one of my classes and needed some help, and it turned out that Karen, Mike's sister, had some expertise in that area. I'm sick to my stomach just thinking about this. Karen had a little house in Laurel Canyon, and Haya dropped me off there. Once again, I was putting myself in a dangerous situation because Karen was a wildcat. By the time I got there, she was already drunk on a bottle of wine, and she'd just eaten garlic soup, which didn't exactly turn me on. But she was looped and insistent, and when you're 18 years old, it doesn't take that much provoking to get you to a place where you can't stop yourself. So we ended up having a very, for me, tormented sexual romp. A huge amount of guilt and shame and self-disappointment immediately followed. I don't mean to say that these episodes destroyed my relationship with Haya. I was able to encapsulate them in a protective wrapping of gray matter and understand that they meant nothing as far as the way I felt about Haya. But there was enough other baggage in our relationship that seemed to ultimately doom it. The major problem still was the conflict between her loyalty to her parents and her feelings toward me. Her parents' disapproving voices were always in the back of her mind. And if anything, her parents' attitudes got more inflexible as our relationship progressed. One night when I was still living in Donde's house, Haya and I spent a few glorious hours together. We were under the impression that her parents thought she was somewhere else, so she was so happy. We were lying in bed, talking and laughing, and it started getting late, and then the phone rang. I picked up the phone, hoping it was a call for Donde, but the male voice at the other end was as cold as ice and as serious as stone. It could have been an executioner. "Anthony," put Haya on the phone. I looked at her, and she knew she had to take the call. She started listening to his tirade about how she was no good and how he would disown her, and she started crying. I tried to tell her that I loved her and that they didn't have her best interests in mind, but she just sighed and said, "No, this is my family. I can't turn my back on them." And she went home to the people who were doing that to her. By the end of that first year at UCLA, Haya and I had begun to have talks about what we were going to do. At one point, Hillel had even given me a chai, the Hebrew letter that signifies life, and I wore it on a chain around my neck. I guess this baffled Haya's dad enough for him to call me into his house and ask about my background. I explained I was mostly Lithuanian, and he liked that. "Did you know that before World War II, 10% of the population of Lithuania was Jewish?" he said. Then he went to his library and got some Lithuanian genealogy books out and desperately tried to find out what the chances were that I had some connection to a Jewish bloodline. I humored him, but I knew it was a lost cause. So Haya and I were having these talks, and they were getting serious and sad because she was driven in school and under the domination of her family, but we were madly in love with each other. The stress of college and her unique family dynamic was taking a toll on our sex life. I was terribly hurt and confused, and my ego and sexual confidence started ebbing. Little by little, our relationship was disintegrating, not in an immature way, but in a profound way, when we both quietly understood that our worlds might be too disparate, and there might not be a future for us. We wound up having our final talk at Hillel's house, which had become a sanctuary for me during that unmanageable year. Hillel gave us his room, and Haya and I looked at each other and said, "You know, this really isn't going to work." Then we lay there in Hillel's bed, holding each other tight and crying for what seemed like hours, because we both knew that this great love was coming to an end. I never made the decision to quit UCLA at the end of my first year. My classes were over, and once again, I went to that job board, but this time I found something really interesting. It was a job as a jack-of-all-trades for a graphic arts film company, and they were paying $10 an hour, which was way over the minimum wage. The company had compact office space on La Brea. The offices were modern and high-tech, and the owner of the company, David, was very manicured, very pristine-looking, and clearly gay. Just by observing, I could tell that he ran a tight, efficient ship. My interview went well. I'm sure it didn't hurt that I was an 18-year-old male, and I started work the next day. My job consisted mostly of running film to the developers, being in charge of the petty cash, and doing whatever else David wanted. This was one of the first companies to specialize in graphic animations for commercials and network logos. David had gotten in on the ground floor of computer animation and was making a fortune. Even though I was just a runner, he took a shine to me and began to explain these complex graphic applications. It wasn't a sexual thing. From day one, we had open hetero-homo discussions about the desirability of men versus women. Even though I was the embodiment of the type of boy he was constantly searching for, he never sexually harassed me or made me feel uncomfortable in the workplace. It didn't take me long to apply my lifelong skill of taking advantage of situations. So when he sent me out to buy personal things for his house, such as a new quilt, I'd usually order two of the same item and keep one for myself. No one ever seemed to notice, and since he had a house in the hills and a Ferrari and a Porsche Carrera, I didn't think he'd miss it. He must have seen me much more for what I was, and much less for what I thought I was getting away with, because he was no dummy, but he let me slide. To me, it was summer vacation, and I was making money faster than I could spend it. Mike was working at an animal hospital, and our friend Johnny Carson, who used to hang out with Haya in junior high school, had a job at Warner Brothers. For years, Mike and I had dreamed of getting our own place in Hollywood, so the three of us decided to pool our resources and rent a nice little house right near the Formosa Cafe. We settled into the house, but 3 weeks later, an even nicer house down the block went up for rent. It had a larger yard and was a couple of $100 a month cheaper. So we jumped ship, battled to get our security deposit back, and moved down the road. Pretty soon, it was evident that JK was the odd man out, since he had a 9-to-5 life working at Warner's. Mike and I didn't let our jobs get in the way of our partying, which, even at the first house, consisted of shooting a lot of cocaine. We'd blast a B-side song by the Police called Fallout, and then Mike and I would shoot the coke and run around the house in a temporary state of euphoric mega-bliss. We'd raise our arms high in the air to stop the bleeding and start rhapsodizing, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, this is a good one, this is the big one, this might be too much, oh no, it's too much, I'm good, oh this is incredible," and then we'd sing along with the song. One rather normal non-coke shooting citizen would have to deal with these two madmen who were paying more attention to their own world than the outside world. When JK planned to go away skiing at Mammoth for a few days, Mike and Hillel and I decided to have the party to end all parties. Mike and I went on a booze-stealing binge and stocked the house. Then we emptied all the furniture out of the house so there'd be more room for dancing. Hillel helped us distribute flyers, and I duct-taped huge letters to the living room floor that spelled out DANCE. Mike had been squirreling away these colorful pills from the animal hospital, not to consume them, but as souvenirs. We had a chest-high, shallow mantle that went all the way around the house, so we alternated patterns of blue and yellow and red pills along the mantle, creating a kind of Japanese rock garden effect. Then the hordes arrived. The booze started flowing, and the music was pumping, and people were dancing and disappearing into bedrooms and going off in the bushes, and it became the best party we'd ever gone to, let alone thrown. As the night wore on, everyone started consuming the pills, not realizing they were for doggy constipation or feline psychosis or whatever. At some point, the house took on a life of its own, as if its energy was pulsating out of the windows into the world. We passed out sometime early the next morning, and when we came to, Mike and I looked around the place. It was a war zone. The floors were covered in an inch of goop. There was food and crushed pills and vomit and empty beer bottles and cigarette butts and general debris everywhere. I knew JK was coming home that night, so I got out some mops, a bucket, water, and soap, and went around that house the entire day and cleaned every nook and cranny. By the time I was done, it looked like no one had ever come over. Even though I was able to hold down my job at the graphics company, I had definitely become a cocaine addict. We had a fairly constant supply, because both Mike and I were making money, and he was able to supplement what we bought by trading bass lessons for coke from some dealer in Topanga Canyon. I looked forward to the days he taught, because as soon as that lesson was finished, we'd be shooting the cocaine. There was never enough to go on for more than an hour or so, but I had a real need to get those drugs in me. The psychological addiction was in full effect. I wasn't physically weak, but psychologically I wanted cocaine constantly. My burgeoning use wound up exploding into some episodes of full-blown cocaine psychosis. One time, I got a hold of a lot of coke and shot it up on myself all through the night and into the next day. I was alone in my bedroom and became convinced that someone had broken into the house in broad daylight. Then I started having visual hallucinations of this intruder going through the house. I'd rush into room after room convinced that he had jumped out of the windows right before I got into that room. So I thought, okay, I know how to deal with this. I climbed up onto the roof of the house, holding an old car tire, thinking that I'd lure the guy out and then throw the tire at him so that it would perfectly donut him and immobilize him, like in a cartoon. Luckily, Mike came home and talked me into coming down. It wasn't only coke that I was abusing. Around this time, I met a punk rock girl who asked me why I would shoot cocaine when, for $20, I could shoot speed and be high for 2 days. I ended up spending a night with her, shooting speed and getting crazy high. Every time I took speed or coke or even a speedball, something would flip inside my head. And no matter what I was doing or who I was with, I'd grab a pencil or a marker or some paint and I'd start drawing on paper or cardboard or people's walls, whatever. I just had to draw the minute those drugs hit me. And if I wasn't drawing, I was having sex. During that summer of 1981, heroin hadn't become prominent on the drug scene. I remember being at Al's Bar downtown with Mike and seeing a whole table of young punk rockers who were nodding out and thinking that didn't look like too much fun. But there was another voice in the back of my mind that had been speaking to me every now and then. It said, "You've got to find some of that heroin again. That's the drug that people are afraid of, so it's got to be the best drug." I wasn't looking back fondly on my 14-year-old's experience with that one line of China White. I was more into the idea of taking a truly subversive drug. One day a new guy came to work. He looked like a rockabilly singer, with a black pompadour, big black Roy Orbison shades, super pale skin, and a bizarre demeanor. I asked my coworker Bill what was up with that guy. "Well, that's the way you look when you do heroin," he said. Bingo. Here was my connection to the world of heroin. After a few days, I approached the guy and said, "Can you get me some of that damn heroin?" He said, "Absolutely, absolutely." Junkies always want to get new guys drugs because they can rip them off. So we made plans to do the heroin that night at my house. I was so excited that I rushed home and told Mike and JK that I was going to shoot heroin that night. "What? You can't shoot heroin, you'll die," they cautioned. I told them that this guy had shot it for a while, and they were so intrigued that we decided they should watch me shoot up. That night, the guy came over and was taken aback to see an audience sitting on chairs around the kitchen table. But he set up the spoons and went through the whole ritual of cooking up this Persian dope, which I'd never seen before. Because it was oil-based, he needed a lemon to cook it up with. First, he fixed himself and got a little stoned, and then he said, "It's your turn." He fixed up the rig, and it was brown. I'd never shot up anything that was brown before. Everyone was on pins and needles, wondering if I was going to die. I shot up, but didn't feel much. I asked him for some more, and he said okay, but this would be the end of the dope. He gave me another shot, and still there was no great, dreamy, go-sink-into-the-couch-and-sleep-for-12-hours opium rush. Later, I found out that the dope he scored was pretty weak. It was a decidedly underwhelming high, and it didn't light my fire or inspire me to go searching out a heroin connection. It was a waste of money, and the grand spectacle of doing it in front of my friends fizzled out, and everyone left. By the fall of 1981, even though I hadn't made a conscious decision, I was not a UCLA student anymore. School didn't fit into this raging, drugging, clubbing lifestyle I was leading. I certainly didn't look like a student. I had traded in my already weird spigot blister haircut for a flat top. I had been seeing flat tops around the club scene, and I thought they looked cool. So I went down to Bulgarian Bud's Flat Tops on Melrose Avenue, and for $4 they shaved off all the hair on the sides and back of my head and left a half inch of hair standing straight up on the top of my head. When I did that, it was like I had totally erased all my ties to my past. Now I was a crazy, out-of-control punk rocker. When I showed up for work the next day, David was amazed. "Oh my God, you've cut off all your hair," he said. Just then a Devo song came on the radio, and I turned it all the way up and started dancing all over the office. "That's a very violent style of dancing," he fretted. But I was off and running into my new identity. The whole time I was working, I was dipping into the petty cash box, getting more and more into shooting cocaine, and drinking lots of alcohol, and taking lots of pills. I didn't see it happening, but the wheels were falling off of me. I didn't care about work. I didn't care about my health. I didn't care about responsibilities like paying rent. I was just on a runaway train ride. The horribly ironic cosmic trick of drug addiction is that drugs are a lot of fun when you first start using them. But by the time the consequences manifest themselves, you're no longer in a position to say, "Whoa, gotta stop that." You've lost that ability. And you've created this pattern of conditioning and reinforcement. It's never something for nothing when drugs are involved. After I called in sick one too many times, David fired me. I felt really sad that I had let him down. I was also sad that the goose laying the golden eggs was gone. Then I got more bad news. It seemed that J.K. had brought a copy of the party flyer we had printed up to our landlord. He told him that we had distributed the flyers in record stores on Melrose and had a wild party that endangered the house. Meanwhile, J.K. had lined up two other friends to move in. By the time his eviction procedure worked, we were ready to go. Our lives had begun to self-destruct to the point where we couldn't have paid rent regularly. Before we left the house, I did manage to scrape together some money and buy myself a used car. I had been using a Capri that Steve and Peggy gave me as a high school graduation present. I never maintained it, so for the last year, it had no muffler and zero brakes. I'd routinely hit the curb with my wheels when I wanted to stop. One morning, the car just ceased, and when I checked the oil, it was bone dry. The whole engine had turned to stone. So I said goodbye to my car, thanked it for a couple of years of faithful, accident-free service, and left it on the street. I picked up a copy of the Recycler and found a beautiful 62 T-Bird for $600. It was big and bad and, soon enough, would become a mobile bedroom for me. For some reason, it didn't faze us when Mike and I found ourselves out on the street. The whole concept of sleeping didn't make much sense to us then. There were all these new clubs opening and a whole post-punk scene developing in Hollywood. There was the Lassa Club and the 01 After Hours Bar and the Cash Club, which stood for Creative Artist Space of Hollywood. We'd end up at these places because we were out all night, every night, going with this invisible flow, following the party. Mike was in a little better shape than I was. He wasn't hitting the drugs as hard, and he still had income from his animal hospital job. When we left the Formosa house, he ended up crashing at the Cash Club. Cash was run by a woman named Janet Cunningham, who had a legit job as an extras casting director for the film industry. If you were an actor or a painter or a musician, Janet would let you crash at this loft space for free. During the day, it would be a hangout spot, and at night, there would be performances. At the time Mike moved in, Larry Fishburne lived there, along with a great Guadeloupean drummer named Joel, a French painter named Fabrice, and an authentic punk rocker named Animal Boner. Not only did this guy have some of the first tattoos I'd ever seen, other than on old sailors, his were on his kneecaps, and they read Metal Kneecap Factory. Because Mike was staying there, I'd wind up crashing there too from time to time. That was when we started doing heroin. Fab, in addition to being an artist, began to get a steady source of China White heroin. It was so pure that you could sniff one line and be loaded. Mike started sniffing it too, but he always remained a lightweight around heroin. The joke was that all you had to do was show him a bindle of H and he'd start vomiting. By now, my flat top was growing out, so one night when we were out in the valley at a party, I asked Hillel to give me a mohawk. I knew he was good with